I'd like to thank you, councillors, for coming along to this special seminar we have this afternoon on clinical debriefing. There seems to be considerable confusion about what debriefing is all about, and so your supervisor asked me to come along and present a seminar on this particular topic. Debriefing. What are its goals? How do we go about doing it? And what are its limitations? Well, let's start first of all with the definition. Debrief has been coined from the French phrase debrief. De meaning from and brief meaning instructions given. Therefore, debriefing is an outcome pertaining to a previous experience. Now, debriefing in our context defined is the process of diffusing, disencumbrancing, and developing following counselling or critical incident. Now, like all technical definitions, this definition has components which need defining. Diffusing is usually a deliberately created opportunity for workers to obtain brief support when they finish a shift. Now, this can be through sharing a report with personnel on the next shift. It could be a brief report or discussion on an area of concern, or it merely be a, "Oh, how did it go today?" from the supervisor. Disencumbrancing is a cumbersome 17-character word which simply means unloading pent-up emotion through retelling frustrational and traumatic experiences. And developing pertains to the exercise of sharing experiences, of receiving information about normal reactions and responses, and developing strategies for future use. A critical incident is any serious and stressful event which either happens to you, someone close to you, or someone you may be called upon to counsel. Counsellors who experience a critical incident themselves are just as much in need of debriefing as counsellors less directly involved, if not more so. Examples of critical incidents would be a serious accident, the death of someone, especially a child, violent deaths such as murder or suicide, many deaths at one time, rape, personal disaster such as vehicle air crashes, disasters such as earthquake, fire and floods, shooting and community violence, being robbed, mugged, assaulted, these sorts of things. Okay, let's talk specifically about debriefing. What are its goals? How do we go about doing it? And what are its limitations? Firstly, let's remember that the immediate consequence of any traumatic life experience is loss. Assisting in the coping of loss presents one of the greatest challenges to every counsellor here, as almost every caller will be experiencing the emotion associated with loss in some way. For example, a relationship problem would reveal a plethora of both real and imagined losses. Loss of support, loss of intimacy, loss of self-esteem, loss of progeny, which also occurs with hysterectomy and menopause, loss of status, loss of freedom, loss of dignity, loss of choice, loss of control, a loss of faith in people and in God. And coping with loss involves in dealing with the emotions of loss. Shock, fear, anger, helplessness, sadness, shame, and other effects of loss, tension, sleep disturbance, dreams and nightmares, fearfulness, intrusive memories, feelings, numbness, irritability, depression, social withdrawal, physical sensations, mental reactions, and self-medication. Look, I'm going through these too fast, aren't I? Let's look at them one at a time. Shock. A disbelief in what has happened. Numbness, the loss may seem unreal, like a dream. Slow comprehension of what has happened. fear of damage to oneself, of death, of recurrence of the event, awareness of personal vulnerability, panicky, irrational feelings. Another emotion to loss is anger. Anger at who caused it, or quote, allowed it to happen. Outrage at what has happened. Anger at the injustice and the senselessness of it all. Anger at the seeming absence of divine intervention. Where is God? Generalized anger, irritability. Another emotion is helplessness. Crises may bring out human powerlessness as well as strengths. Another emotion is sadness about human destruction and losses of every kind, and for the loss of the belief that the world is safe and predictable. Another emotion is that of shame for having been exposed as helpless, emotional, or needing others, or for not having acted as one would have wished. These feelings are common. Expressing them allows nature to heal, and usually they only last for short periods and gradually diminish. Different feelings may be dominant as the time goes by. And in addition to these, there may often be other effects of loss, such as, well, tension, more easily startled, edgy. Or maybe sleep disturbance, not just the inability to sleep, but thoughts that prevent sleep and replaying of the incident. Dreams and nightmares of the incident, or rather frightening events or possible outcomes. Fearfulness of the incident or locations associated with the incident. Intrusive memories and feelings. These interfere with concentration and daily life. They may be flashbacks. They may be attempts to shut out the things that cause us to deaden the feelings and the thoughts. Another effect of loss can be, as I said before, numbness. Feelings seem to be shut down. We have a loss of interest or involvement, avoiding things that evoke emotions, like reminders. And then there's irritability, frequent mood swings. There's depression about the event or past events, non-specific depression or guilt about how one behaved. And then there's sometimes social withdrawal, this need to be alone. And we find that very difficult with telephone counselling, if getting it out of the person because of their need to be alone. Physical sensations, tiredness, fatigue, palpitations, tremors, breathing difficulties, headaches, tense muscles, aches and pains, loss of appetite, diarrhea, constipation, loss of interest in sex, nausea, menstrual disturbance, the list goes on. Mental reactions, such as poor concentration, difficulty in thinking, self-doubts, poor short-term memory, loss of confidence, confusion. And finally, self-medication, taking pills and drinking alcoholic and caffeine beverages excessively to deal with stress, distress, or intrusive memories. You know, exposure to some or all of these effects of loss may create in the counsellor a need for debriefing. Maybe the easiest way to explain debriefing is to use the word debrief as an acronym. I'll just list this off quickly, and then we'll go through each word, one word at a time. D for defuse, E for experience shared memories, B for bathos for euphoria or build up for depression, R for review, I for information, E for education, and F for a fresh start. Right, let's go through them one at a time. Number one, diffusing. In the case of exposure to a critical incident, diffusing preferably needs to take place within 24 hours of the exposure to the incident. This should really be a process preceding debriefing, although it may be included in a debriefing session if it has not been experienced earlier. A debriefing proper should take place within 24 or 72 hours after a critical incident exposure, and at least weekly for full-time counsellors in regular practice. Part-time counsellors may either need less frequent debriefing, or, as is more often the case, the opportunity for more extensive defusing after each shift. Number two, E, experience shared memories. One of the goals of debriefing is to help people to unload an experience and to learn from the shared experience of others. Those being debriefed are seen together as a group and ideally should include as many of the team as possible to be together at one time. There's no shame, nor should there be any stigma attached to attending or feeling the need to attend a debriefing session. Naturally, Christian counsellors will choose to include God as one of their number in debriefing sessions, with a prayer and brief inspirational devotional segment. Typically, a session will take 2 to 3 hours and commence with sharing information, the group setting its own rules about confidentiality and conduct. Examples of such rules may be attack the issue and not each other, the problem and not the person, one person to speak at a time without interruption, or we must not condemn repetition. Facilitators who carry out debriefing should ideally be specially trained professionals who are knowledgeable about debriefing processes, group dynamics, stress management, and reactions to trauma and to loss. People are encouraged to present their experiences, and usually one or two specific shared experiences will emerge. Thoughts, feelings, reactions are all discussed and may be ventilated. This is what we mean by disencumbrancing. I stress, though, that there should be no demand that ventilation need occur. Number three, this is the letter B in our word debrief. It can be one of two things. It can mean bathos for euphoria or build up for depression. In a way, debriefing allows for a group telling of individual experiences. Bathos, from the Greek word for depth, is the ability of the group to bring you down to earth. If you've got unrealistic euphoria, this may be due to receiving one side of a story and misinterpreting the implications. Let me give you an example. Supposing you've just heard the choice of a repeated counselee to separate herself from the cause of her grievance. Unrealistic euphoria may also be due to a hysterical response by the counsellor to a particularly distressing counselling session, and they need to be brought down to earth. This group discussion may help this counsellor to come down to reality and resume usefulness. Build up is a far more common role the group can perform for counsellors. Hearing depressing tales of woe for umpteen hours at a time may in itself be depressing, couple that to the frustration of realizing that there are times when you feel powerless to help, at a loss for words of encouragement, out of your depth in expertise or experience, or confronted with an unusually complicated scenario. Little wonder. Depression causes so many casualties in counselling circles where debriefing either doesn't occur at all or not regularly enough. Sometimes debriefing sessions may need to include the dynamic of some other aspects of group tension relief, such as progressive relaxation exercises, deep breathing, or physical games, such as balloon or ball throwing or aerobic exercises. This may become appropriate when either a session is overly prolonged, when tensions are running hot, or when the facilitator sees the possibility of the session turning into what is colloquially called a gripe session. Actually, some debriefing group facilitators make team games a part of every debriefing session. However, I think this can be a little overdone. The letter R in our acronym is review. Despite the anxiety that some counsellors feel about such things, reviewing a shared experience with role play or dramatisation is both beneficial in disencumbrancing and in educating. It's through this review component that we experience a not threatening shared mobilisation of support. Questions hidden in the recesses of the timid counsellor's mind are often answered by the more experienced. Sharing different approaches to the same incident may both reveal and recognise counsellors' individual strengths and weaknesses, but a facilitator skilled in affirming, praising strengths and building on weaknesses will make this component most productive and non-threatening. Number five, the letter I in our acronym debrief is for information. We all need to gather statistics on the types of cases we're presented with, both for our own use in planning, goal setting and budgeting, and as a requirement of management, government and funding bodies. Debriefing sessions may provide an opportunity for these statistics to be gathered more representatively than the standard report forms many of us are used to. For example, our reporting system may record that we, as a group, dealt with X number of cases of rape in the past so many days. But the debriefing session may reveal that such and such a percentage of these were from a particular ethnic community, or workers at a motor assembly plant, for example. However, a debriefing session must never take the place of your regular written reports and case notes as an adjunct to these. Number six is the letter E for education, and all debriefing sessions should include an education component. To some degree, this is covered in earlier media, such as the role play, but closing a debriefing session with specific training by a social or health professional in some relevant area can both relieve the tension of the session and provide valuable in-service training. Simply having a social or health professional at your debriefing session can be advantageous. And number F is for a fresh start. Professional debriefing has proved to be a useful and productive, supportive process. Although because of its individuality, it has had little systematic evaluation in terms of outcome, it is perceived positively by most professionals. Its acknowledgement of people's experience is both a symbolic as well as a real aspect of its value. Nevertheless, there are significant numbers of counsellors for whom it will not be adequate. It may not be at the right time. It might not meet their needs. It may be they have felt no opportunity for self-expression. may be that they fear exposing their vulnerability. Perhaps they feared losing control. Studies have shown that some people will continue to be highly stressed despite professional clinical debriefing. And for many, although it is perceived to be helpful, it may not lessen their symptoms of stress and distress. Some may not be able to use debriefing because of shock or denial. It's essential that debriefing not be seen as a cure-all, but is available as part of a safety net of backup and support, including further educational, personal counselling, rapid and effective professional intervention when problems arrive. So debriefing then is an avenue for counsellor growth and togetherness. Coming together is a beginning. Being together is advancement. Staying together is progress. Grieving together is balming. Sharing together is healing. Praying together is growth. Experiencing together is development. And working together is success. And now we have time for some questions, if you have any. Now, for those who didn't hear that question, the question was, how can I help a parent who is grieving over a sick child in hospital with a terminal illness? This is a very important topic, and in fact, if you just give me a few seconds to think about it, maybe I can come up with some suggestions. The parent has certain responsibilities and duties, and if in your role as a counsellor you can draw these to the parent's attention, especially if you can help the parent to think that they were their idea in the first place, may be of benefit to the child as well as to the parent. The parent's responsibilities and duties are really summed up like this. Number one, they need to be honest about their emotions, their capabilities and their limitations. As a parent, you must learn to enunciate your feelings and acknowledge the fact that you need support and understanding. Secondly, I guess as a parent you need to communicate your concerns to the doctors, the nurses, the caregivers. You have a responsibility, I guess, or a duty to get some sort of training and understanding from people who can show you how to deal with both the physical and the emotional needs of your child. And the social workers at the hospital will in fact be able to help you in this area. The parent also has a duty to try and to be honest in their relationship with the patient and with other family members. To let them know you're hurting. Share it. But don't wallow in it. Make it your job to seek some help is another responsibility. And of course there are individuals and organisations, there's plenty of people who are willing to assist. But of course you'll have to make the initial first contact as a parent. The children are more comfortable when their parents are present during treatment. So you need to learn as a parent to steel yourself to discomfort and pain and fear, remembering that acceptance and encouragement are vital to the attitude of your child. I'm probably looking at this more from a parent's point of view than a counsellor's point of view, aren't I? Maybe another responsibility of the parent would be to realise that they are the child's advocate. As a parent, you're a key person in every facet of treatment and care. Strong, loving, knowledgeable parents who have made themselves expert in active teamwork with professional caregivers are finding an outlet for their love and their concern. There'll be less frustration when participation and sharing are the modes of operation. And as parents, we have the right to challenge treatment. You have the right to a second or even a third or a fourth opinion. You have a right to question the validity of prolonging life in a hopeless situation. You have the right to question and the right to expect clear, intelligible answers. Somehow, parents know intuitively what is best for their child. So insist that this intuition, if you like to call it that, is respected. You can help the parent as a counsellor. If the parent can express and expect guilt, it's normal to wonder if perhaps your actions contributed to the cause of an illness of a loved one. They need to discuss their guilt feelings with someone who understands, and here's where you can help them to relieve this burden. Parents also need to be encouraged to use all the tools at their disposal, support systems, information, discipline, religion, philosophy, and counselling. The parent can also be encouraged and helped to make life good and happy within the limitations placed on them and their family. To seek for themselves comfort, normality, relaxation, and rest. Parents need to be reminded sometimes when they have a sick child that each day brings new discoveries and new hope. That they can be as brave as they decide to be. It takes practice to be courageous. And parents need to be allowed to fail occasionally too, but to keep trying. I guess another one would be to take your comforts and rest wherever you can and wherever they're available as a parent of a sick child. And not to allow yourself to be wooed by drugs or alcohol. A healthy body, and this goes for we counsellors as well, is our best weapon during troubled times. Take care of yourself. And I guess in answering your question in summary would be to suggest that you help the parent to be able to find ways to make the time that they have with this child quality time, to build happy memories. They're going to be bittersweet, but they'll be lasting. They need to make friends along the way, to buoy them up and share their load. They need to take time for thinking, praying, resting. One of the hardest battles a parent will ever have in life, and they need all the reserves they can find, and your help is there because they have sought for it.